the paper.
Welcome to episode 33 of Paper Talk, a monthly series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and today I'm talking with Mabel Grummer, the wife of Arnold Grummer. Their daughter, Kim Schiedermeier, is here too. We talk about Grummer's career, which eventually led to the family business that Kim still runs today and provides papermaking kits and supplies for educators and artists. Look them up at arnoldgrummer.com. After studying English, communications, and education in Iowa, Grummer worked at the Institute for Paper Chemistry in Appleton, Wisconsin, where, among other things, he was the curator of the Dard Hunter Museum, which is now the Paper Discovery Center. The Dard Hunter collection moved to Atlanta in the 1990s and is now at the Robert C. Williams American Museum of Papermaking. We talk about how Grummer developed a quick way to show the general public how paper was made during brief tours of the museum, and how this eventually led to the fabrication of the Great American Paper Machine, a soup-to-nuts papermaking machine based on the British hand sheet former, and a tool that allowed him to show people in a matter of minutes how to make paper from pulp to dry sheet. If you go to HelenHebertStudio.com, click on Podcast, and then on Arnold and Mabel Grummer, you'll find a photo of the machine there. After his stint at the museum, Grummer took his show on the road, teaching children, visiting museums, and sharing papermaking with people around the country. He wrote how-to books, appeared on television, and developed kits for sale so that anyone could make paper at home, at school, or in their studio. And Mabel was instrumental at all stages of his career, as you'll soon hear. Enjoy our conversation. Well, Mabel Grummer and Kim Schiedermeier, welcome to Paper Talk. I'm so glad to be here in Appleton, Wisconsin with you today.
Well, this is going to be fun.
Yeah.
Helen, I'm glad to be here.
Thanks for coming, Helen. It's so special to have you here in Appleton.
Yeah. Mabel, tell me how you met your husband, Arnold Grummer.
I was going to summer school at Iowa State Teachers College. I only had a two-year teaching degree, and I was trying to get it finished, and I was going to summer school, and he was back from the war and was, I think, a sophomore at that time. And a friend of mine was married to a friend of his, and they suggested we get together that summer, and so we started dating and dated for about a year and were married the following summer.
Okay. So you were in Iowa, and then he was studying communications?
Or he was getting an English major at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he graduated in 1949. We met in 1947, were married in 1948, and he graduated from Iowa State Teachers College in 1949 and started working at the college in the radio department. He had a very beautiful radio voice and had been working there as a student, and then they hired him full-time when he graduated from college. So he spent 2 years doing that, and after in that period of time, in 1950, we had Mark Grummer, and he decided to finish his GI Bill, and we went to Iowa City for him to get a degree in radio and communications at State University of Iowa. So he had a master's degree from there.
Okay, so tell me a little about the GI Bill, like what he got for that.
For the GI Bill, since he went both year-round, summers and during the year, he was able to get his bachelor's degree completely on the GI Bill, and he had enough left by doing the same thing, going summers and during the year. He went one full year and another extra summer to get his master's degree. His writing that he did was, I think it was 15 radio programs on safety for the Iowa State Safety Department, and I think they were used.
Okay, and so let's fast forward to paper. How did the paper all begin? And also, you were you teaching this whole time as well?
I taught before I met him, and I taught 2 years after we were married. And then I also taught a partial year in North Liberty, Iowa, while he was getting his master's degree to help with our finances. And then I took time off, had 3 children, and spent time being a mom. And then went back to teaching. And he had a heart attack when he was 43 years old, so I went back to teaching at that time. And I taught until I retired in 1949 with a teacher strike there in between.
And how did Dad end up at the Institute?
In 1957, we came to Appleton in 1957 for a job at the Aid Association for Lutherans, which was a communications job. He had been teaching high school in Osage, Iowa at that time, and they hired him at Appleton to work at the Aid Association for Lutherans. And then he had, when he was working there for 3 years, a salesman from the working at the Aid, but also at the Institute of Paper Chemistry, was talking to him about this job at the Aid, at the Institute of Paper Chemistry, and said maybe he would fit that job. So he went to the Institute and applied for the job that they had, and he was interviewed 3 or 4 times by the president, and they decided they liked him, and they hired him, and he started work there in 1961.
Okay, and what was his, the years aren't that critical.
No, but I was going to look at the name of the job.
Oh, the name of his job.
I didn't know if you were going to ask that or not.
It's okay.
But it was a communications job. What they wanted him to do at that time was to work with students on their
PhD programs.
The PhD program, but also on their, what it is that they write, was that called?
Dissertation.
Their dissertations and the making sure that those things were correct and that kind of thing. That was part of his job. They wanted him to do news reports to give them publicity. And so he actually was a communications person. And the beautiful thing about his president was that he allowed all the workers to kind of go in the way of their talents, which is very wise when you think about it. And so Arnie, as time evolved, he found different things that fit what he could do. Lots of times it was writing. And then as time went on, he started showing off the Dard Hunter Paper Museum when they had visitors. In fact, he took visitors around the Institute for everything. If they wanted to see the labs, then he had to make arrangements with the professors, so the people who were teaching, to go into their labs with the guests. So he was very familiar with all parts of the Institute in a short time because he was doing those tours. And then he also had them tour the museum if they were interested in the museum. So he slowly got acquainted with the museum. And pretty soon, since he was so excited about the museum herself, he was doing some pretty wonderful tours.
Right, and so the Dard Hunter Paper Museum, do you know when that was there before Arnie came?
Yes, and there's a whole history on how that came from the place it had been in the East Coast. There'd been some unhappiness with MIT. Dard Hunter and having it there.
Yeah.
And I could look up that history for you, too.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Anyhow, there was unhappiness with having it in the East Coast. So he had it moved to the Institute, and I don't know the exact year, but it was already established at the Institute when Arnie was hired to work there.
Right. So I think through his tours and being the face for the museum, he came up with a quick way to show people how paper was made.
One of the things he really desired was to have some kind of an instrument to show them what paper is, because mm-hmm. he always had to start the tour on what the papermaking process is. And the beauty of his job is that he was not only connected with all the scientists at the Institute and kept learning from them all the time he was there, but he was also involved with the commercial papermaking people in the valley and getting answers from them on certain things. And certainly when they went through the tour of the museum, he had to know about the commercial papermaking business, because that was important for the things that Dart Hunter had collected mm-hmm. to know about both those aspects of the papermaking industry. And so he was able to communicate that, but he thought if he could have something like they were using in the labs to make their sheets that they were testing, to show them exactly what happened in the papermaking process, he would be able to start his tours with that instrument. So right. when it came time to build the machine that he later used, he had to be one of the advocates for the money that was going to be spent mm-hmm. to make something new for the Institute. Mm-hmm. And there were other people that were asking for things too. So he had to make his case for building this machine that was like the machines that they were using in the labs mm-hmm. for him to use in the museum to explain papermaking. So he won, mm-hmm. and to the cost of about $5,000, they built what later became the Great American Paper Machine, mm-hmm. and it was built to the specifications of the British hand sheet mold that all the scientists in the labs used all over the world. So he was really happy to have that. Also, the fact that it was a small sheet, which was easy and fast to make, right. was a good thing, too.
So it made about an 8-inch diameter disc of yes. paper. And it went from pulp to dry sheet in a few minutes?
Yes, mm-hmm. it went from pulp to dry sheet. And in spite of all his talking, he made it within 15 or 20 minutes.
Okay. He was a showman.
Yes, he could. He could vary it. He could make it in 5 minutes, and he could make it in 50 minutes. So right. it just depended on what he's doing and how long he thought they would stand and listen.
Uh-huh. Okay, and so, yeah, that's fascinating. And so then... how did that lead to, well, a tin can paper making, I think, kind of came from that?
Well, yes. People? Yes, he wanted to make it simple enough for little kids mm-hmm. to make a sheet, to seniors to make a sheet. Mm-hmm. And he wanted something where mostly what he was interested in when he did that was to have the teaching of how you made paper and what it was. Mm-hmm. And so he was not worrying about it being a handsome sheet or a gorgeous. He was worried about the fact that it would be small and a good sheet and made quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's how he got into what he later called tin can papermaking, which was another book that he wrote. His first book was Paper by Kids, which he was lucky enough to have a company that wanted a book on papermaking, and they wanted it for kids. He did have to argue a little bit about the title. They didn't like that very well. Mm-hmm. But as you can see, he won that battle too.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. And so did that come about? Did he have lots of kids come to the museum?
Yes, he did.
It was all kinds of people.
Yes, and yeah. they never gave him any mercy on what age they sent to him. Mm-hmm. He had everything from kindergartners to high school, college students, adults. Mm-hmm. So he had all age groups. At the Museum of Science and Industry, they one time gave him a group that was all the way from kindergartners to eighth graders in one group, and mm-hmm. he had to keep those kids interested for almost an hour, and he did it. I mean, they were fascinated with what he was saying, and he was able to make it simple enough for the little kids to understand, but yet exciting and interesting enough for the eighth graders. So that was a true test of what he could do.
Right. So how long was he at the Paper Institute?
He was at the Paper Institute. I was figuring it out. I think it was 14 and a half years.
Okay, and then after that, he kind of went out on his own.
They had a new president. The wonderful president that he had all those years was retiring, mm-hmm. and they had a new man come in. And I think it was in the mind of the Institute to be sold and go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of discussion about it. I don't know that it was solved at that time. But I think that that was their intention of some of the people, that they were going to move it. And one of the things that happened is that the Institute was an organization of research and development, and many of the paper mills were now doing that in their own mills. And so were then, in the past, they had come to the Institute to do their scientific work, and they were now doing it themselves and didn't need the Institute any longer. So their role had changed with the times, mm-hmm. and so they had to let people go. Mm-hmm. And they looked at the things that Arnie was doing, and they decided they didn't need those things anymore if they were going to cut down a lot of jobs. So he was in the second wave of people who lost jobs, and that was in 1974. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, in 1973, the school I was teaching in went on strike, mm-hmm. and we were all fired in 1973. So in 1974, in the spring of, I lost my job. Then following spring, he lost his job, but he worked for, I think, 3 or 4 months after he knew that he was losing his job, so he had some time to look mm-hmm. and to do things. And mm-hmm. so in fall of 1975, we were both without a job. So we were, I had told him that I didn't think I was going to be able to get a job in the Fox Valley because they seemed to discriminate against fired workers. And so we were going to move, but I was able to get a job in Appleton, right, and sort of at the last minute of our budget. Mm-hmm. And so then I said to him, okay, I can bring in the health insurance and a stable salary, and why don't you get a van? And the Institute had awarded him the Great American Paper Machine because nobody knew how to work it except him. Okay. They sold it to him for $1, uh-huh. which we thought we could afford.
Right.
And he brought it home, painted it red, white, and blue, and called it the Great American Paper Machine. Oh. And I said, okay, buy yourself a van and get it all painted up and take your show on the road, because you're good enough, I think, mm-hmm. that you can get enough work to do that by just letting people know you're available. And so he slowly developed that. It was kind of slow business, but mm-hmm. it was also very exciting and something that he absolutely loved doing. So it was a good solution for us. And I kept my job in Appleton until 1989 when I retired, and then I went on the road with him. He was still going on the road at that time, and we went into some places.
Were your kids still at home, or they were grown by then, when he started on the road?
Where were you, 75? Kim? You were,
no, I was away at college and graduated and married. And
Kim was the last one in college at that point. Greg was in the service, had been in the Air Corps, and Mark was already lawyering, so...
Right.
They were on their own, so it was a time where we could take chances like that because they were well established, and we didn't have to worry about that. We were ruin their lives by the choices we made, so we had some leeway in what we could do.
So he packed everything in the back of the van and drove around. So how long was he gone at a time, and what kind of places did he go?
Okay, he went to schools, mm-hmm. and it was very interesting because if he got a school in one town, and they had several schools, he very often had follow-ups with the other schools because they liked his program so well that the other schools wanted to do that for their students too. So mm-hmm. We did all of the Nina schools, lots of Green Bay schools, mm-hmm. and somebody hired him and paid for his way into the high schools in Green Bay. So he did all the Green Bay high schools. And he did many schools in Oshkosh. I was just talking to someone last night who remembered him being at her school. Mm. And in fact, she liked what he did so well that she echoed him and continued it after he left by herself.
Oh, how wonderful.
And we went to some Chicago schools. One of the interesting school things we did after I had retired was a paper mill hired us into the Arkansas schools, and he hired us in for a week, and we had 4 days of teaching in that system, mm-hmm. all the various schools, and they were grade schools and high schools. So that was a very interesting thing. We lived in their guest house for that mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. So, and then we also did the Art Association of school in Texas, Beaumont, Texas, and we did that for 2 different years, their festival. And we were hired many times by paper mills, would hire us in for either schools or for the mill itself. So, and then he went to the Miss Smithsonian probably 4 or 5 times in the years that he did that. 2 for festivals on the mall, mm-hmm. which were long days. Mm-hmm. He would start at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I would tour D.C. by foot, mm-hmm. enjoying the sights of Washington, D.C. and learning a lot about it, visiting all the museums,
yeah.
and pick him up at 5 o'clock, and he was still going strong at 5 o'clock.
This episode of Paper Talk is sponsored by the Red Cliff Paper Retreat, an annual retreat held at Helen Hebert's studio in the heart of the Rocky Mountains of Colorado every September. Enjoy 3 or 5 peaceful creative days in the tiny hamlet of Red Cliff, surrounded by mountains, the river, and aspen trees as they begin to change their glorious fall colors. Experiment with several techniques as you create a variety of paper objects that will intrigue your eyes and illuminate your spirit. All levels of art experience are invited. The 2019 retreat theme is books, vessels, and containers. How do you store your stuff? Come explore a variety of papers that can be cut, folded, stitched, and manipulated to create books, tubes, pockets, envelopes, maps, bags, and more. Explore these ideas as you create unique paper objects with a dozen like-minded creatives. Find out more at helenhebertstudio.com/Red Cliff Paper Retreat. Now back to the episode.
So what would a day look like? So people would come through. Would everyone get to make a sheet of paper?
No.
Would he just talk to them about it?
It was all talking and demonstrating. Okay. And the demonstrated, I would say, lasted between 30 minutes and 45 minutes, depending on how interested they mm-hmm. seemed and how restless mm-hmm. they seemed to go. Mm-hmm. And if he captured them, they stood there that whole time. Mm-hmm. And it was just amazing how something like that, being science and really a learning experience, how people would hang around for that.
Right.
So I was just amazed that anybody could start out early in the morning and still be just as excited at 5 o'clock as they were at 8. It's at 9 o'clock.
And so when he went into a school, was it the same? Just a demonstration?
Had that time. We did. When I was with him and did the schools,
yep.
he had time to, he could do a 45-minute class, mm-hmm. and the way he worked that out was to tell the school ahead of time that either they should have some moms to help us, uh-huh. or he had a way that they could figure out to use students if they couldn't get moms, that they could use students and have that work. And so that what we would do is he would do a 10-minute discussion on what paper is and uh-huh. why it bonds and all of that. And then he would have three or four tables set up with equipment with a student or a mom at the head of that table to make sure that they did everything okay. And then we had a lab dryer there. And so they went through that whole process. They usually learned one art technique and had a sheet of paper in that time that they could take home because it was dry.
Mm-hmm. And so did they use a blender to make pulp?
They used blenders, uh-huh.
There was, so they did the whole there process.
There were four blenders. There's a blender at each table.
Okay.
And one or two tubs to form the sheet, and then one or two stations to get the water out, and then plenty of coot sheets and plenty of screens, and you have enough equipment. So they can do the whole process.
I mean, they had a press. Did you take the press with you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We had presses at the end of each. No, I think the presses were in a neutral position, and I think we had two presses to four tables, something like that. It seemed to work.
Okay.
So.
And these were presses that he built or designed?
He had designed a press with a jack that you use to jack up your car, a 2,000-pound jack. And that worked just beautiful. And the thing about the jack was so appealing to the boys.
Uh-huh.
And they fought over who was going to get to use the jack.
Right.
So the jack didn't deter anything from the fun of making paper. They also loved the blender.
Oh, I'm sure. And then were they dipping sheets or?
No, they were pouring. This is the pour method.
Okay.
This is a method that Arnie believed in. Because a lot of the paper makers don't like the pour hand method because they think they don't think it's elegant enough, I guess. Mm-hmm. But he liked it because it showed the process so well and helped the understanding. And also, it was so easy to form a really good sheet.
Right.
And this was one thing that the teachers told us afterwards, that when we made paper, the papers all went home with the kids. They weren't laying in the playground somewhere. They throw away on their way home.
They were so
proud of them that they always took them home. So
what were they pouring into?
They were pouring into a deckle that was one that he designed.
Mm-hmm.
Early on, we had a latch on it. Mm-hmm. Later on, he learned to use Velcro.
Right.
And make it much simpler
mm-hmm.
because it was less expensive to buy mm-hmm. when people wanted to buy it. So he was able to improve the design after a while, and it works really slick.
Yeah. And then talk a little bit about the dryer that you used in the classroom.
Well, the classroom, we had a laboratory dryer, the same. He fashioned all of his equipment after what the scientists used.
Right.
So he would go into the scientists and he'd say, now, how can I make this so anybody can use this mm-hmm. or I can use it out on the road or whatever? That's just like the scientists do. And so that's why he developed both the coot sheets and the dryer method. Later on, when we didn't have the dryer anymore or weren't taking it, we would use on iron and ironing boards, which is a little more dangerous and still more student involved than the laboratory dryer was. We didn't allow them to handle the laboratory dryer, where we did allow the paper maker to dry the paper with an iron.
So they
did the whole process when we had it set up that way.
Right. And then, Paper by Kids, we briefly mentioned, his first book.
Yes.
How did that come about?
We had a Minneapolis publishing company who came to the Institute, and they talked to the president, and they said, we want a children's book on paper making, and we figured that you're the place where you know all about this, and you might have someone here that you think could do this for us. And so it landed right in his lap that he had a chance to write a book, and he also had a chance to work with the people in deciding what they wanted. He was able to work with the editor on chapter by chapter as they sent him ideas, and he was able to say, no, I can't do that, or no, that won't work, or yes, that'll be wonderful, and whatever. And so he had this one editor that he really worked with well, and they got this book produced. So,
wow.
The little models that we picked for the cover were only on the first edition. If you're going to buy the first edition of Arnie's book, you'll want the edition with the two kids with their... the boy had the long hair of the times. And the little girl was our neighbor right up the street here. So, and we she went to the same church we did, so we were able to get her. And so...
And so then how did things go towards, I know kits were developed and more books. What was sort of the timeline?
Well, the developing of the products, well, the books were certainly a product that people always wanted. The thing that happened every time he went somewhere to make paper, they said, this is so much fun. How can I do this at home? And so he would tell them what they could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so... many times they would come back later and they said, well, you had all those ideas for us, but I wasn't able to get that, or I didn't have the time, or I didn't understand it, or whatever. So then the books seemed like a really good idea, because you can hand them a book, there's everything there,
right,
and they can figure it out themselves. Then if they come back and said, well, I didn't really want to do that, but I'd really love it if you had something. Now, this is where I caught on to this, because I thought, you know, he's giving away everything he knows, and he's giving it away free, and he never has any reimbursement for it. So I thought we really needed to have products for, at that time, for the person who just wants to do it right now, and they want to have something in their hands to take home. And so we started developing the products. He did this rather... not enthusiastically.
Not a business person.
No, he's not a business person, and he'd rather give it away than to sell it. Except his books, he was always happy to sell those. But he was not ever what I would say downright enthusiastic. But I would say he went along with it, because we went to we were on. What is this program? QVC. He's on QVC.
Oh, on TV, right.
He had how many kits? 400?
He sold 1,100 kits
in 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
You told
yeah,
me.
Yeah. So he was very successful at sales if he wanted to do it. And he was very excited to do that, actually, because anything where he can do television or be in front of people is always one of his loves.
So what was that kit?
That was very much the same kit we have now, with a decal, coot sheets, press bar, a sponge.
I think it was a paper mill. It was the paper mill. That was the beginning of the paper mill, which is
our
classic.
We call it the paper mill. Yeah,
the paper mill.
And it's the one that is now the decal with Velcro and so on. It's really slick, because it just makes... it's just such a small little unit, but it makes such a good sheet in such a short time, and so it's the same thing. And I don't know whether we had the Velcro or the latch.
You had the Velcro by then.
Velcro by then, okay.
And all the person needed was a blender and recycled paper.
Yes.
And then they could make a sheet all the way to dry.
Yeah. Right. Yes, they needed their own blender. We didn't ever... get into blenders, although we always recommended certain blenders to people because of the way they lasted. We knew by then which ones lasted in that tough role of making paper, and ones that didn't, so we could recommend. But we didn't do them, because blenders were something we just didn't know how to do, pay back if they had trouble with them, what we would do about that, because we'd have to work through another company and so forth. So,
and it'd be a much bigger kit.
Yes, yeah. And also they could find blenders in thrift stores.
Right.
So that was a way to recommend paper making without big investment beyond buying the kit.
Right. And so 1,100. And so you were packaging those up and doing fulfillment yourself?
At first we did a lot of it ourselves. Uh-huh. We even made them ourselves at first because it was just a case of satisfying the person at the demo that wanted mm-hmm. one. And we didn't mm-hmm. sell a lot. Mm-hmm. We went to the Renaissance Fair between Miss Wisconsin and Illinois on the border. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's a town there or not, but it was a Renaissance Fair, and we had a booth for 3 years, and that gave us a good indication of what kinds of things we needed to have. We sold Fabriano watermarks, we sold papyrus, mm-hmm. and we sold handmade cards. They sold really mm-hmm. very well. We were really surprised about that. And the thing I was finding that I was teaching during the year and doing Renaissance Fair in the summer, and I was exhausted after a while.
Wow. You did everything. Yeah.
But it was great fun. We just had a wonderful time. Kim can probably tell you some things about that.
Yeah, I think we're going to do a second interview with you.
Okay.
So tell me about his videos, because I know he has videos that have been watched a million times or half a million times. And
well, we usually paid those ourselves, mm-hmm. and you had a lot more to do that than I did. Okay. The ones
it was your idea, because you saw in the paper that the cable company was offering video development to community people as part of their community outreach.
Yeah, the TV company, huh?
Yeah.
Yes. And so we decided at that time, I don't know that we decided on, what did we end up with, three videos? I don't know if we decided in the beginning to have three videos, but it kind of worked out as we went along. Mm-hmm. And they were very helpful in dividing that up into ideas and so on. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones that people can get on YouTube today.
Right.
So they've stood the test of time mm-hmm. simply because Arnie, as we go back to his history, you remember it started in radio.
Right.
So he had a very good voice, and he knew how to phrase things and make them understandable to people. So that was very helpful in all the stuff that he did after that, was to have that background.
Right.
When he was in the service, he also worked in radio.
Ah.
That was a little different. That was sending messages. But still, radio is radio, and your express thing is to be understood. And so that was always a big, big advantage in all of the things that he wanted to do and got a chance to do also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, he surely brought papermaking to the masses, I think. He spread the word about it and was able to break it down into, that anyone could do it.
Certainly I think so, and he thought so, mm-hmm. and I think he did do that. And he was truly, truly excited about it.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to say it wasn't a put on for him.
Right, and that makes it authentic.
Yes.
Yeah. So that... And did he ever teach teachers? And I mean, through his books, of course, but...
Yeah. I don't think he ever had a chance to do workshops for teachers, although we went to a lot of teachers' conventions, mm-hmm. so he was teaching mm-hmm. them there, and mm-hmm. he made a big impact mm-hmm. all the time when we did that. That was we had some interesting experiences, but we tried to hit as many teachers' conventions as we could afford, and mm-hmm. we found out that there were good ones and some that were not so mm-hmm. workable, but... some of them were really good, and the people were really interested and wanted him to come back year after year. So we did as much as we could in that, because conventions were also very expensive to go to.
Right, right. And so when did you stop traveling around and doing the...
I think the business went to Greg and Kim. Kim started in the business first, and mm-hmm. Greg came along shortly after, mm-hmm. and that was 1992. And you can tell by the books, you know, I kept the record here up to 1992 and a little bit longer, but mm-hmm. it's their job if they want to keep any records of it from here on mm-hmm. in. But anyhow, that was very slow, and it wasn't an immediate transition, I'd have to say. I don't think you'd take this business away from him in one fell swoop. That just wouldn't work.
Right.
But she was very good about including him in and giving him assignments, which he just loved, that she did that. And she sort of became his marketing agent, is what he always needed, was a marketing agent.
Mm-hmm.
And he never, when he had to do it himself, he was never as enthusiastic about marketing as actually doing the job. So,
right.
And that's sometimes a quality that people don't have all in one person.
Sure. Well, that's wonderful. And I think you had the idea to get her involved.
Well,
she said you brought things over and asked her to start packaging.
She was involved helping when we had the little kit, the little $9 kit.
Mm-hmm.
And her kids packed it, right?
Mm-hmm. In the basement. But my memory of that was you showing up at my house and saying, Kim, I kind of like you to think about doing some stuff with this. I kind of like you to call some museum shops and do some things. And I'm like, oh, okay. It's like,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She's good at that.
That's kind of how I remember it all. Kind of happening over the kitchen table.
Right.
One thing we have learned as a family business is that each person brings something to it, but you can't always do more than the ones that things are good at. And so we had to kind of figure out what we're all good at.
Right.
And Greg was a whole nother part of it later on, and he was a good thing. And the thing that surprised us about Greg is what a good presenter he was. He was almost another Artie in some ways.
Uh-huh.
And so you saw him the other night.
Yeah.
He's just so good at that, and people are so drawn to the way he presents things. So, and he's also a poet, so here we have these qualities these four people that are mm-hmm. working on this business. And we used to have business meetings with the four of us for quite a few years.
Oh, that's good.
So we were each able to vent what we thought we were good at and could do and
mm-hmm.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
And we slowly relaxed. I certainly relaxed in the kind of things I did, and I was very welcome to be told, also to be told what to do and what things I could contribute to. I was very glad about that.
And still contribute.
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
You look at me at my age and you say, wow, you look young for your age. And that's the full reason. And I thank them many, many times for keeping me busy
mm-hmm.
with something to me mm-hmm. that's very meaningful. So
what are you still doing today?
I make cards for them to use in the business, but mm-hmm. also Dave to use in his practice as a doctor.
Uh-huh.
And I work on the screens, and I work on anything that they think that I can do. I worked a lot on the development of the
instructor certification.
Mm-hmm. Wrote out all the ideas for that mm-hmm. I had and mm-hmm. so on, and mm-hmm. I don't know where that is in its progress now, but those kinds of things are very exciting for me to do. So
great. Well, thank you, Mabel, and I do think we'll just break it into two sections. I'll mm-hmm. interview Kim separately about kind of where the business has come and what's going today. Is there anything we left out?
Well, I'll probably think of something later. I can't think of anything now. There's so much to it, you know.
Right.
There's so many happenings that you can hardly pick out one thing to talk about.
Right. Okay, well, thank you so much for being on Paper Talk. I look forward to sharing your story.
Well, that's great fun.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog.
I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon. There's a reason besides the season.